Okay, well, hello and welcome to the January 2025 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for current DMSC students and faculty, and frankly, anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. We have the unique opportunity to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and healthcare who have made a significant impact. So, before we begin, a few reminders for our attendees. Please keep your microphones muted and feel free to share any comments or questions in the chat section during the presentation. We will have a Q&A session at the end where you can unmute yourself, and Dr. Beth Popray, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat for any questions or comments. But let's move on. It's really a pleasure for me today to introduce our guest, Curtis Manley. PA, MPAS, DFAA, PA. Kurt was a family practice PA for over 24 years. He joined the United States Navy after graduating from Kingman High School in Kingman, Arizona. During his 26 years of active naval service, he served tours of duty on six different ships. He deployed many times to the Western Pacific, including Operation Desert Shield and Operation Desert Storm. And additionally, he served with SEAL teams in operation supporting democracy in Haiti. Kurt received his Bachelor of Science from the University of Nebraska when he completed his PA training at the Inter-Service PA program in 2001. He received his Master's degree in PA Studies from the University of Nebraska in 2003. He has earned the designation of Distinguished Fellow of the American Academy of Physician Associates. He was selected as a Civilian PA of the Year by the Veterans Caucus of the AAPA in 2017. He was also awarded the PA Physician Partnership of the Year Award 2019 by the Arizona State Association of PAs. In 2020, he was awarded the Preceptor of the Year by the AAPA and the Physician Assistant Education Association. He has served on the Board of Directors of the Arizona State Association of PAs. He's a member of the Board of Directors for the Veterans Caucus of the AAPA. He's also a preceptor for PA students at Northern Arizona University PA program and has earned the designation of clinical preceptor by the AAPA. And Kurt recently retired from full-time practice. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that. But Kurt, welcome to our master class and certainly thank you for your service.
Thank you, Randy. It really truly is a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's jump right into it, Kurt. During your 26 years of active naval service, as we mentioned, you served on six different ships and worked with SEAL teams. Really, what was the most crucial leadership lessons you learned from operating in these high-stakes environments? And then tell us a little bit about how you came to become a PA.
Well, I think the key to in that environment where I was at, on the ships that I was on, I was what's called an independent duty corpsman. You at the time we went to school for a year, trained in how to go to ships that were without a medical officer, a doctor, or a PA at the time, or later on. And one of the things that I learned more than anything else, that teamwork is the absolute key to success and the most important. Now, when I was, although it was independent, I always had a junior corpsman. Whoops, wrong button. I had a junior corpsman that was there, that was assisting me. So learning teamwork was the key to success and making sure that everything was the way that it was supposed to be. Where I came, my transition from being a corpsman to going into PA school was I was young in the Navy, and I was lucky enough. I had a chief that taught me that to make the Navy work for me instead of against it. I had an illustrious first term, we'll just say. I did all the things that necessary to get promoted quickly through the Navy. To go to independent duty school, which was almost a guarantee to make chief, as long as you did what was supposed to be done. And being in a war zone during Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, it's kind of the baptism under fire. You just had to be in that position to know that what was there available to me if I needed it. So I made chief or E7 right at the 12-year mark. And obviously, I knew at that point I was going to stay long enough in the Navy to make it a career. But then what was I going to do for the remaining time? Early in Arizona, I was introduced to a guy by the name of Bill Perkins, who was the third PA in the state of Arizona. He was the provider in the little town that I was at the time. It was called Dolan Springs, and he showed me a lot, took me under his wing. I got lucky enough to have some doctors take me, and I knew that PA school was a dream. After I made the decision to go towards PA school while I was in the Navy, right about that time, the Navy did away with the program. They put on a hiatus for a certain amount of time. So I said, okay, fine. So I'm going to just continue getting all of my prerequisite stuff out of the way. And so that's what I did. And then about that time, the program came back online, and I was lucky enough to get into the program when I did. So.
Yeah, and you went to the inter service program down there in San Antonio, right?
Correct. I did first year in San Antonio, and then our second year for all of our rotations were done at the Naval Hospital in San Diego.
Right. Do you remember who your program director was? Just out of, so okay.
Not in San Antonio. In San Diego was Casey. So no, I don't remember his
That
name. Is
that's okay. We're just curious. Well,
okay. It was a couple years ago.
and so obviously after you got out of PA school, you continued serving in the Navy as a PA, and then at some point transitioned to civilian health care. How did you adapt from military to civilian work in a small town in Arizona? What core principles sort of remained constant across both sectors?
Well, in the Navy, the core principles of the Navy are honor, courage, and commitment. And obviously, that takes on a whole new meaning from what you were talking about, what was courage and what you're committed to. But the honor part didn't change. I mean, you did always did the right thing, and that can transition both active duty and military, or active duty and civilian. I just made sure that I was always did the right thing. I could make sure that I could look in the mirror and say, okay, yeah, you did the right thing today. And you had the courage to then to stand up for the things that were right. And the right thing, and being able to talk to your administrative people, whoever that might have been, and talking to them and say, you know what? This needs to change, or this is not right, or this is a good thing. We should expound on that. And then you just got to be committed to your employer and to your profession and to your community.
Yeah, well said. And tell us a little bit about, once you get out of the Navy and you started practicing there in Kingman, Arizona, you may or may not remember, you invited me up many years ago to come up and speak to the residency program there, and my wife and I, and we really enjoyed that trip up and getting a chance to meet with you. But tell us about your experience of, I mean, as you know, the PA profession really was created with you in mind, with working in a small rural area, underserved area, and that's and you know so tell us a little bit about the your experience, some of the pluses and minuses of working in a small town.
Well, when I started here in Kingman 15 years ago, there was three PAs at the time, and a couple of nurse practitioners that were here, and it was a new thing. It was new to Kingman. It wasn't obviously, and it wasn't new, but it was new to Kingman because they had such a such a need, an absolute need for providers. And again, here in Kingman, it's really rural. There's not much here. Yes, you're 100 miles from Las Vegas, but it's still what you're looking at here. You're just trying to get providers here was difficult. And a lot of times they would come in. The residency program that you had were speaking at was one of those that was, they would get in here, they would do their residency, and a lot of times they would leave. And so getting providers to stay was very difficult. So for me, it was an opportunity to really express on how the PA profession could work to the benefit. You could, and so you and I, and there was a lot of times I was beating my head against the wall saying, no, look, here is what we could do. Here is what we, even specialties, your cardiologies and GI. And right now we have at the hospital, there are PAs in the urgent care, in orthopedics, in thoracic surgery, in gastroenterology, in oncology, of course, the primary care. And nephrology has them, and that's just at the hospital. So that being able to make sure that they could understand what we could do and what we could bring to the table.
Why did you stay there? I mean, you said 100 miles from Vegas. You could certainly have a better lifestyle in Vegas, or what, 2.5 hours from Phoenix.
Right.
What kept you in Kingman?
To be really honest, there were two things. One, I grew up here. My wife is from here. Our kids were here, and the grandkids were here. So, and I could see the good that I was doing. There was a need, and I was providing a service. I've worked family practice pretty much my whole career, and that was not the direction I thought. I thought I was going to be an ortho PA. But in the Navy, you worked the family practice clinic until it was your turn to go on deployment. When you came back from deployment, you went back to family practice because that's where it was easy to keep you until it was your turn to go on deployment again. And then, as I was getting ready to retire from active duty, I had an invitation to apply for an ortho job, excuse me, with one of the guys that had operated on me. And through an administrative glitch, I didn't get it. And then when I was working here, the opportunity to expand into ortho was there, and it didn't go that direction. So I'm a spiritual enough kind of guy that realized that three times I tried to get into ortho, and for three different reasons that they said no. So family practice was then I began to realize what a service that was needed and what was, and that became my calling. And so I knew that my leaving family practice would be bad for the community. It would hurt the community. And so there was that. I wanted to do something good. And that was where I was at. And I was having a lot of fun with it. And I was teaching, which is what I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I remember working in a small town in Utah, Kearns, Utah, and you couldn't go anywhere in town without running into a patient, going to the drugstore or the grocery store, and you'd run into a patient. And I'm sure you've experienced that.
All the time. A day does not go by that I don't walk into the store and they go, oh my God, I can't believe you retired, or any number of other things that, makes my heart that I knew that I did the right thing, Christine.
Yeah, I think I remember a story that you told me back when you were trying to decide what to do in Kingman, that there was a physician there that sort of took you under his wing and sort of gave you some advice. Am I remembering that story correctly?
Well, there was we kind of was a dual-edged sword. Justin Garrison was a family practice resident. He was actually at that lecture that you gave, and he was that he had come to Kingman because he had done all of his research trying to figure out where he wanted to raise his family. He was from Phoenix, and we met each other during his first year, and we just kind of molded together, and just we had a great team together. And then life happens, and then he didn't stay in Kingman. He moved on and went to went to he's in Tennessee now. But it was a good team of how to make that. And he was the one that I when I we got the award for the Physician and PA Teamwork Award, and he was the one that did that. And that was it was one of those things that one of the proudest moments of being able to do that together. And I use him as an example on the relationship between the PA and their supervising physician all the time.
Yeah, we talked a little bit during the introduction about you receiving the distinction of being a distinguished fellow of the AAPA, which sort of attests to your leadership skills. So, talk a little bit about not only being a clinician but being a leader in the community. What separates exceptional healthcare leaders from merely competent ones?
I think that in leadership is different for everybody. And and I always used to say when I was in the Navy, and I used it, leadership 101 is find out what their wants, needs, and desires are, and take them or give them away or give them back, whichever one works the best as that tool goes. And I used that same concept both on and when I was on active duty and when I was in, you have to know your people. You have to you kind of worship two gods. You have that this end of the chain of command of the people that work for you, and then the other side of the coin is the people that you work for. So you have to have that bigger picture and be able to mold it into the smaller picture that you can make what the company of where at the time was Kingman Regional that had this big picture of what they wanted to accomplish. And then you had to adapt it into seven or eight different people on how to take those cogs in the wheel and make it the bigger to make the wheel so that it ran the way that that made the people up at admin happy.
Yeah. Well, a minute ago, you said you really like to teach, and it's obvious being recognized as a preceptor of the year and also the PA physician partnership. What's your philosophy on mentoring the next generation of healthcare professionals? How do you balance teaching technical skills and leadership development?
You know, the when I was, as I took more and more students, I realized that they had all of this great knowledge that they got from their first year of school, but they didn't know what how to put that into use. They could verbalize the answers. They knew what to do, but if they didn't know how to do it. So I used to do all of that. I trained it as the philosophy was I was training my replacement. And I used that thought process and I told them that I'm training you as my replacement. So that means that if you were to come to Kingman and work in family practice, and I knew that I could turn my patients over to you and they would be in good hands. And that thought process was the same thing that I used when I was in the Navy. I would train my replacement so that, because everybody's replaceable, even me. But everybody's replaceable, and that you need to make sure that your patients in our world, you know, if you go to a job that, you know, you're not there anymore, they bring somebody else in. But in our world, you're taking care of patients. So that it's traumatizing. And I didn't realize the impact that I had on patients' lives until I was doing my quote unquote farewell tour in those last couple of months before I retired. What that impact was to them. And yes, they were happy for me. Who's going to take care of me now? And that concept is if you are training your replacement and teaching young PAs or students or even seasoned PAs how to take care of them the way that they are used to taking care. They're not me. They know that. But you take them on that same guidelines. And they're going to do much better in that respect.
Yeah, well said. Well, your recognition for the PA Physician Partnership of the Year really suggests some strong relationship building skills. And certainly in this day and age, with so many other healthcare providers out there, and and hospital groups. What strategies have you found most effective for developing professional partnerships and leading across sort of organizational boundaries?
Well, I'll take from with my supervising physicians. So it kind of goes back to most of my time when I was in the Navy. I worked independently. I was on ships, and that was before cell phones and sat phones and or internet and stuff like that. So you had to learn to make decisions and trust your gut. And if and but you weren't going to be afraid to ask for help, knowing that if I was going to call a doctor saying, "Hey, I need some advice," that was going to be a $3,000 phone bill, and it had to come out of somebody's budget. But you had to learn to trust yourself. But you also had to learn to trust the people that you work that worked for you, and you had to learn that supervising physician. You had to know what his likes and dislikes. And I use Dr. Garrison as an example. I'm not a football fan. I kind of know what's going on, but I'm not a football fan. I don't spend a Sunday afternoon. However, I knew that he was a ridiculous Dallas Cowboy fan. So I can guarantee you that every either Sunday night or Monday morning during football season, I watched SportsCenter so I knew how they did. So that I knew what kind of mood he was going to be in. And a few years ago when Dallas had like the best record in NFC or whatever, and they were the front runners to get to the Super Bowl, I knew that if they had won the Super Bowl that year, I could ask him anything I wanted and I was going to get it. But I knew that about him. I also knew he was a huge Kobe Bryant fan. So I knew to walk softly, pick up the load, because he was devastated when Kobe Bryant died. So I knew what I needed to do to make that transition easier for him. That's part of it. You had to just know what that was about. And then as you're talking about with other, the as nurse practitioners and where they are in the process. So there was a nurse practitioner that I worked with here in the clinic. So they were actually, it was Dr. Garrison, this nurse practitioner, and myself that were the team. And we were the A team. We were they everybody referred to us as the A team. And many providers at many of the medical staff asked us why. What's the difference between Lori and Kurt? What can they do and what they can't do? So Lori and I put together a lecture that we gave to the medical staff is the differences and the similarities between nurse practitioners and PAs. And they walked out of that the lecture itself might have lasted 20 minutes, the presentation lasted 20 minutes, maybe, but we had almost an additional 20 minutes of question because they just don't know. And even in today's world, as PAs and nurse practitioners are out there a lot, but there's still a lot of providers, doctors that don't know what we can do. And with, I think it's our job to teach them, this is what we can do. This is how you use me. This is how you make, and for them, money talks. Because you can, what you pay a PA in family practice and what you pay a doctor in family practice, you can hire two of us for the price and still get as much work done. They begin to realize that when you look at it that way.
Yeah, good advice. Let's talk a little bit, go back to the military a little bit. Your career spans just an impressive number of years of military service. And so you must have seen how the role of PAs in the Navy and in the military evolved over time to what it is today. What are your the thoughts in terms of, I mean, we may have PAs who want to, go in the Navy or the military, and tell us a little bit about where it's been and where it's gone.
Well, anybody that's attended even one lecture about, or talked to the PA History Society or they know the Historical Society. We know where it started. It was the Navy corpsman that, excuse me, Dr. Stead had brought into the thing that, but where it is at today, the irony of it all is that that vision started because there was such a shortage of primary care family practice providers throughout the United States. And now that it has evolved to the point, and I'm actually a rarity when you look at the numbers of providers that have been in family practice my entire career, and how they go into that, the specialties, the cardiology, the orthopedics, the emergency room. Those are the glamorous position. Family practice is not glamorous. Primary care is just not. But I can't imagine more of a rewarding job that I can do right now. There, to me, but that's me, but the where it has changed and how they're being utilized. I mean, the providers that the PAs that were, higher ranked. If you made commander when I was in the Navy, if you made commander, you were something. That was an 05. And now, just recently, the Army selected its first brigadier general last year. Had the pleasure of meeting him at the conference last year. He was at the Veterans Caucus at the memorial service. I got a chance to meet him. But the public health service has had admirals, had an admiral that worked its way up through there. And so that utilizing both as for me from a naval officer standpoint and making command or captain 06 and now making admiral, they're out there. It's going to happen. And when I retired from active duty 20 years ago, not something that could even say. We used to joke about I'll be the first, PA admiral. That was the big joke in our class. But the highest that anybody in my class got to was lieutenant commander or 04, not because they weren't qualified, but it wasn't there.
It certainly has gotten better for sure. Well, let's jump into some professional practice questions. As you know, AAPA a few years ago approved our professional title to be physician associate. And as you may know, the Oregon Association of PAs just changed their title to physician associate. A number of specialty organizations have done the same. And some PA programs are changing their degrees to physician associate. What are
Right.
your thoughts about this?
Well, I think that, and I was always a proponent of it because the assistant, you get the confusion of what a physician assistant is. Or you're just you're a medical assistant. No. Then that leads to a whole lot of confusion. I think that the physician associate leads a better term as to what that means. But I still think that there's much to be done in letting your community know what that means. And it's a constant, not as much here in Kingman anymore because we've done such a good job of letting them know what we do. There was some confusion as to what the assistant associate does that change? Doesn't change my job at all. It changes what we are called and what the community sees us at, that as the association with a provider. And I think that that helps a ton. And I think that at the beginning, I think that the AAPA did a good job of putting the information together. I think that we need, as practicing practitioners, we need to make sure that the community knows what that means. And many of the PAs here in town have not adopted it. I'm a PA. Okay. And most people now know what that means. And I don't, my ego's not that big, but people know what a PA is in Kingman because of me. And I worked hard at that. And I gave lots and lots and lots of presentations to like Rotary, Seroptimus, the whole during the, I don't think a year went by that I didn't present to somebody during PA week. So when the mayor did the proclamation of National PA week, so I gave a presentation to the mayor and the city council. The funny story about that is I probably had 200 people behind me at that particular meeting, and they presented, and I turned to start to talk to the crowd instead of talking to the city council. And the mayor said, Mr. Manley, could you present to us? It was a habit. So
That's a great story. Well, another issue, as you know, is the degree that PAs have, and you will remember back when, well, in fact, early on when PAs got certificates and then bachelor's degrees, and then in the 80s, the master's degree. But you know, in the last 10 years, the post-professional programs like our DMSC has started, and in fact, as of this week, there are 30 programs that are DMSC programs in the country, you know, PA centric, but the question that I have, I mean, I think those are here to stay, but the question has come up: should, you know, PA programs move to an entry-level doctoral degree? The PAEA voted to keep it at a master's degree as the entry level. So, what are your thoughts about the entry-level doctorate?
Okay, I'm kind of old school. I think that if you are going to achieve a doctorate level, me back up just a minute. So my program, when I got out of my program, it was a bachelor's program. But I knew, and I was blessed, the Navy paid for that. And when I knew that I wanted to teach, no matter where I was going to be at, I knew that I wanted to teach. To teach, I needed to get a master's. So I had to go back to school to get that master's. I mean, I had to work extra hard. I had to work extra to get what I wanted. So I got the master's. And now that the program, and when I started working exclusively with NAU and their students, and then I talked with AT Stills and also Midwestern here to take their student. The very first question they all asked me was, "Do you have a master's?" They didn't care what in. They all I cared is that I had one, which was great. And to be honest, if the doctorate programs that are here now were there 20 years ago when I was in the Navy, Navy would have paid for that too. But I think that PAs that want to go that extra mile, that want to show that they're doing that extra thing. I think that the entry level should stay as a master's. And I mean, again, it's still, you got to work really hard to get into the program, whatever program you go to. So I think that somebody that wants to work in that direction or where they want to go, I think they should do put that extra time, that effort, whatever, however that works to get to that point to work for that. I don't think that because they went to this particular program that was a doctorate level, yes, they have to work extra hard to get it. I'm not saying it as the way as I wanted, the way I'm thinking. I think that they need to get to become a doctorate, you need to be to give that extra, to give that extra mile and not be part of the program. You have to work extra for that.
Yeah, I got you. Well, you know, the next question is really looking at, you know, your longtime experience as a clinician and educator. Our students in the DMSC program, you know, are obviously are all PAs at different stages in their career. I mean, we have students who are right out of PA school, and we have people who are at the very end of their time as a PA. And in fact, you know, a couple of years ago, we had one of our students who was 70 years old who graduated. He had retired. He had sold his practice. He wanted to write a book, and he wanted that doctorate. So, and we're finding out that PAs should go through the DMSC programs. Either want to move into education, they want to move into some leadership role, you know, either, you know, at an institution like Mayo or in the military or VA or the public health service, those kinds of things. Or three, you know, they want parity with the nurse practitioner colleagues. So my question to you is, with your experience of a lifetime, what advice would you give our students as they graduate? They've already been a PA, they're going to graduate with this new degree, about the future of the PA profession. What would be your advice?
Don't forget where you came from. When you're always talking about, and I can relate it to from a standpoint of from when I crossed over from an enlisted person to an officer, one of the things, and you hear it forever, is never forgetting where you came from. And it's a kind of goes the same thing here. You're going to go into a leadership position. Having that doctorate behind your name gives you some credibility on the basis of before they even met you. that it sets a stage as to they're going to go, okay, so we're going to interview Bill Smith, and Bill has a doctorate. Wow. Okay, that means he is dedicated to what he wants to accomplish and what his long-term goals are. This is the direction that he wants to go. That's going to put him at the front of that list from an interview standpoint. And it's also going to stand, you're established with this person. A new person comes to work and they go, okay, our boss is Bill Smith. He has a doctorate in whatever. He's a DMSC graduate at AT Stills. Okay, all right. That tells us that he's got his stuff together enough that he's going to put that extra effort. He knows what he's talking about. The credibility goes way high because right now, more so, PAs with a doctorate aren't nearly as common as our nurse practitioner colleagues.
Yeah, good point. Well, Kurt, I'm going to sort of start landing this airplane, and but talk a little bit about it. I mean, you're retired now, and if I remember correctly, you're moving or have moved to Oregon. Tell us a little bit about what your retired life is about, and tell us what you do for fun.
I shoot a lot of pool. I shoot a lot of, and Dora and I are traveling a lot. We have between now and October, we have 7 cruises planned. And we just phone called today because I'm still down in Arizona wrapping things up, and found the possibility of 2 more because we're doing a relocation cruise. The ship is moving over to Barcelona is for some work over there, and then it's going to be there for 3 weeks. And we decided we thought we were going to fly back, and then she found a cruise that cruises Greece during that 3 weeks. So we're going to do that and then ride the ship back. So we're going to do that a lot, with the irony of spending my life at sea, which is how I spent my life before. The difference is I won't be in harm's way. That's a good thing. So.
That's great. So remind me if we ever get together not to play pool with you.
Oh no. I've seen the pictures of you and your boys. No, we'd have a good time. We would have a good time.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm going to open it up to some questions from the folks that are here
Sure.
that they might have. So, Dr. Delaney, you have your hand up. Unmute yourself.
I will, and I'll turn on a camera too, just to say
Yay.
hi. First of all, thank you for taking time to do this, and thanks for your service, and thanks for and congratulations on your award. That's a terrific award, and also thanks for being a primary care PA. Randy asked some great questions, and so I have some questions about those questions. I'm not a name change advocate. I'm going to be very or a title change advocate in the military, because you are an officer. Was there confusion when a military person came in and saw you as a physician assistant? They didn't call you Curtis PA. They called you Major.
Lieutenant. Right.
So what? No one ever addressed you by the first name of Curtis, right?
That's correct.
So one of my arguments, and one of the things that I did that you sort of described, you did, is train people to take over for you, to take your role. And my rule when I was a preceptor was you dress like me, which meant you wore a tie, and I worked in orthopedics. When I was in the operating room, I wore a tie, I wore a white coat, and I expected my students to do the same. Because
Right.
if you look like a nurse and you look like an MA and you introduce yourself like an MA, I think you're confused. And I was always referred to as Mr. Even physicians refer to me that way, nursing, et cetera. And so I tried to pass that on because I felt that confusion was is if you lower ourselves to a different level, then we're going to be thought of by patients in a different level. So that was one of my sort of things. And I think I kind of figured that in the military there wasn't much confusion about your title and what you did.
No, not at all. Not at all. And
And
my
the other sort
was
of thing
based on
is
what I wore on my collar.
And the other sort of thing is you use the term independent a number of times. And so the autonomy of a military PA is totally different from that of a civilian PA.
Yes, but I was able to take that, what I, the confidence that I learned to do that, to make it work so that when I was, because for most of my career, with the exception of 2 years that I was in the same building with Dr. Garrison, my supervising physician was never with me. It was either across town or at another base, or in this case, in another state.
I only meant that because, one of the things I get from students all the time and from or people call up and say, should I join the military? And my answer to them always is yes. I mean, if you think that you're not treated fairly in the civilian world, wait till you go to the military world. It's a whole different sort of thing. And if you want autonomy, you're going to get autonomy. Or they, I just think I personally I think military PAs are some of the best PAs in the truly believe that.
Thank you.
I don't want to take all the questions. I have more, but if Melinda has some, I don't want to interfere with her.
You're getting put on the spot there, Melinda.
Yeah, no, I don't have any ones. We're getting ready to watch the ball game, the championship game, and been writing lectures all day. We're all snowed in here in Texas without any snow. But everything's closed tomorrow.
Down Texas.
Yeah.
The power stays
We
on.
don't know how to act and if it gets below 30. But Curtis, it's been really great listening to your stories. My program director is a Navy PA, and so I get to hear the Navy stories all the time, which are entertaining. But it's was good, and thank you for the things that you've done for our profession and for your community. That's awesome.
Can I ask who's your program director?
Lance Bean.
No, I didn't. I
Yeah,
figured it's a small enough
he
world,
was
but
in
it's
San Antonio. He was in San
okay.
Antonio
Okay.
for the last few years teaching.
Okay.
Yeah, so, but it's great to hear your stories. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Beth, any questions from you?
I don't. You know me. I always wait to see if I hear anything about with if you have a dog or not. So that's always
We
a.
do. We do. I have a long-haired dachshund.
Oh, perfect.
But he's up in
Perfect.
Oregon with my wife, so.
Oh, nice. A Navy man. My dad was a Navy man and a dog lover. So there you go.
That's great. Well, thank you guys. Kurt, I know you're on the board of directors of the Veterans Caucus. Give a little elevator speech about what the caucus does and both at the annual conference and also in every December.
Well, I have to tell you, I was introduced to the Veterans Caucus right after I retired, and that was by accident. I was actually at a AAPA conference, and every May at the National Conference, they do the memorial conference for a memorial ceremony for PAs that military PAs that have been just served, or many times it did, and their sole purpose is about setting up scholarships for students for that are veterans. And but they do such an amazing job, not just afterwards. They just recently they set up with a group out of Nashville that does that. They sit down with the families, and it's a therapy for PTSD. And they basically they sit down, and these are guys that have written songs for Garth Brooks, George Strait, all the big names in Nashville. And they sit down and they write a song. They tell the veteran will tell the story. And they'll tell them the story, and they'll talk, and the wives and the family members will talk to them, and they'll tell them the story about what they went through, their buddy Bill, their buddy Jim, and what that meant, and what, one that they did at this last ceremony was about a guy that was had such tremendous PTSD because he was there when his buddy Jim was killed in action, and they wrote that song. And what that song did for that veteran and that story that told, and I guarantee you, in that little room that they were, that ceremony was at, there was, and when they performed that song, nobody knew Jim. because that veteran that the song was about wasn't there. But nobody knew Jim, but I guarantee you there was not a dry eye in the place. Not. Because it just, and it was so, and then they told the story about how the veteran that that song was written for, how he's doing now. Long-term therapy. But that song was the catalyst to getting him feeling better. So they do a lot of good for students before and doing, they do, I believe it's six scholarships now. And then we do, of course, there's a board meeting. And then in December, they do their annual conference, which is called Topics in the Tropics, which is just fun because it's, I don't know where you're at, it's cold in December, most places. And they always, the conferences are always, so this last year, we were in Curacao. Next year, the conference is in Costa Rica. And I believe the following year it's in Panama, but don't quote me on that. But it's 20 hours of CME. You're in class in the morning, do a lot of team building, a lot of social activities, and getting to know. This invitation from Randy came on an evening. We were sitting on a sunset cruise that the Veterans Caucus Board had put together. So it was me and Randy and my wife were sitting there, and we were just talking about different things, and he came up with this invitation that we came to. So just a good group, and it just I'll tell you the story. We were sitting at dinner, and they told the story about how the first scholarship and fundraising event started out at a social event, dinner with for a bunch of veterans. And there was a guy there by the name of Mike Milner and Admiral
Martsugu.
Morsugu. I knew I had it backwards. They were there and they were talking about, and one of them came up and said, "We're going to pass the hat. Whatever we get, we'll match." So the hat was passed and they raised $3,000 plus the match, or the rate with the match it was like $3,000. So that came around, and so they pulled up one of the bags and we passed the hat that night at dinner, and there was probably 150 people in that room, and we raised almost $6,000 just by passing the hat. And that all went to the foundation that they're now going to do with raising more money for students and getting a, and then all of the scholarships are going to come off interest. And they have the financial guys that are working this out, and how are the donations going to this, and how it's going to work to make more and more scholarships for students, for veterans.
Perfect. Well, thank you. And when I edit this video, I will put the Veterans Caucus link to that on this video. So thanks for sharing that.
You bet.
I'm gonna close this up, but Curtis, any last words before we move on?
You know what? I'm actually thrilled beyond to be able to talk to people, mainly because I like to teach, but to give a different view. And the reality was, years ago, I looked at getting mine, and I, ironically, through AT Stills, and not this program, but it was the. They said that you only need an additional 20 hours. It takes about 20 extra hours a week at the time. And at that time, we had just opened our restaurant. We had just opened up this catering business. And I didn't have 2 extra hours, much less 20. And many times I keep thinking back and forth, should I, should I not? And every time it was just busy. So I applaud all of you guys in taking the time to do this and moving forward with this. It's way cool.
Well, we so appreciate you being with us tonight and sharing your life, and it's really an inspiration. And for everybody that's here and viewing this in the future, please join us next month on February 17th for our next masterclass with Jessica Savetic, PAC. Jessica is the founder of Citrus Aesthetics Med Spa and is the visionary behind Citrus Franchising, which are solo practices, med spa, focused on genuine and ethical aesthetic medicine with natural results. So it's a little different this time. By the way, Jessica is a graduate of our A.T. Still University master's degree program entry level. So we hope that you'll join us next month. Thank you for joining us today. The best to all of you. And now go watch the college football game. Thanks, Curtis.
Okay, Randy, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.